Our next case this morning is number 04-1687, Maycor Issues and Rights Limited against Telelabs.
May it please the court. My name is Arthur Miller, and I am appearing on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, the class. This case provides the court with an opportunity. I won't say whether it's a good opportunity or a bad opportunity, to try and lend some guidance to the district courts in this circuit and obviously to the profession at large with regard to the Court of Appeals is thinking about the pleading structure under the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act, the PSLRA. This circuit has not yet had a case that really focuses in on certain aspects of the pleading structure under that statute. It is our belief that the district court erred in several different regards. Most of them are process issues. Rule 12b-6, and that was the motion made below, that is the appeal before your honors, which gives you de novo review, has always required the district judge to read all of the allegations in the complaint in the light most favorable to the plaintiff.
But Mr. Miller, of course there's Rule 12b-6, but there's obviously the PSLRA, which significantly modifies the notice pleading regime that we normally have under Rule 8 and that Rule 12b-6 operates against. And I think the difficulty that every circuit is struggling with is, on the one hand, one doesn't want to require perfect knowledge and an entirely complete account of what happened in the pre-discovery stage. But on the other hand, there are significant specificity requirements that the PSLRA requires. And where in the middle of that spectrum of pure notice pleading on one end, perfect information on the other end, where do we put the point is what everyone's trying to struggle with.
And that is exactly the opportunity I spoke about.
I understand. We know that. And the question here, just to throw out one of the issues that your opponents have raised, is whether this particular complaint on a defendant-by-defendant basis has done so, whether we know enough about Scienter with respect to Mr. Notebart, whether we know enough about Scienter with respect to Mr. Burke, et cetera, and Telelabs itself. So maybe you could turn to that.
Well, with deference, that requires you to go back and as your starting point, and I think this is what district judges should do, you read the complaint. You read it with fair intent, with drawing the inferences favorable to the plaintiff, and then, in a sense, you put on your PSLRA hat. You say, thus read, as the jurisprudence in many circuits since the PLRA indicates, can I find that strong inference of Scienter? Now, in terms of Mr. Notebart, we're talking about the CEO. We're talking about the highest-ranking corporate officer. We're talking about what he knew in the fourth quarter of 00, first quarter of 01, when he is projecting these images that the Titan 5500 is strong, he's seen no diminution, growth is expected, 30%, No, the decline in the telecommunications industry has not surfaced, at least as far as Tellabs is concerned. And then again, with regard to the 6500, he's saying it's available. He's saying demand is increasing. We're going to manufacture and ship. Now, the truth is, as the confidential sources reveal, orders for the 5500 have been declining probably as early as the third quarter of 00, clearly by the fourth quarter of 00 and the first quarter of 01. So you say, how could he be making those statements?
Well, I mean, what your opponents do two things, I think. They, first of all, challenge the confidential sources. I mean, there's the supplemental authority we have from the Chubb Corporation case and others. They're saying, is it enough to say a confidential source said X, Y, and Z in a conclusory way as opposed to just saying X, Y, and Z in a conclusory way? That's their allegation, of course. And the other thing is, they point out that the company wasn't exactly going under. You know, was, in fact, still making money. And maybe this is just, you know, corporate sunniness. You know, maybe he just thought things were fine even if they weren't quite as good as he had hoped.
I'm an investor in that company. The CEO, reinforced by the founder of the company, the CEO for decades, and now the chairman, are issuing statements and signing documents talking about a 30% growth rate, which they know, based on the core product. We're not talking about one of a dozen products. We're talking about the core product and, in the case of the 6500, the hope for the future. They know, based on all of the internal reports, based on pure common sense, these two people don't know for months that sales are declining. I suggest that, to use three words from a district judge in this circuit, Judge Haldeman, that I find charming, those are statements that are discordant with reality. And if they're discordant with reality, they are reckless. And if they are reckless, that creates your strong inference of scienter. Remember, the inference doesn't have to be the only inference. The strongest inference, it can be one of several inferences. This is pretty powerful.
Well, you have the background reports, particularly that company's study that show that the 5500 demand is going down. On the other hand, what seems to be missing in this case, particularly with respect to Notebart, is any motive to misrepresent where the company's going. He's not an inside seller. How does he get helped by this rather short-term strategy of channel stuffing and all of these
things? At one level, we don't know. At another level, at this juncture, I'm not sure it is critical. We're not pursuing this on a motive and opportunity basis,
no,
as is recognized.
Right, yeah.
We are pursuing this on recklessness, sheer recklessness. Either they knew and their statements are discordant with reality, or they didn't know but had a duty to know, as the two top officers of a company making statements about their core product. Now, we don't know about his motive. It might have been sheer ego, Your Honor. You know, I'm the CEO. I don't want to be tied to a sinking ship. Certainly, Mr. Burke, as the founder, is emotionally invested. Mr. Notebart might have had loans outstanding. His stock may have collateralized the loans, and that might have, a sinking market might have required him to put up more collateral.
Did you need to plead that? I mean,
I realize we
can speculate about
these I don't think so. The statute says, did you plead a strong inference? We suggest that that does not require weighing the evidence. It does not require drawing conflicting or competing inferences. There you would be getting dangerously close to a jury trial problem, which Judge Oberdorfer noted in footnote 26 of his City of Monroe opinion. The statute says strong inference. When the CEO and the chairman are making statements that facially are discordant with reality in an environment in which it is inconceivable that they didn't know. Does the chairman, if the chairman of General Motors was standing before your honors and said to you, I haven't a clue how many Chevrolets we've sold, or some TV network CEO said, I think Program X is doing wonderfully, when you've got Nielsen ratings showing it's not doing wonderful, would you say, hey, there's a strong inference of scienter here?
But you're almost saying that if you're the top person in the company, if you're the CEO or if you're the chairman of the board, there's just going to be a presumption that you know what the underlying, at least at a level of generality, maybe not down to the last vehicle sold, but you're going to know if Malibus are doing well and something else isn't.
If you choose to speak, if you want to be dumb and comfortable in the back room, just keep your mouth shut. These people did not keep their mouth shut, and the investing community is entitled to have honest statements. Isn't that what the current trend toward corporate responsibility and managerial responsibility is all about?
And we have other statutes, of course, that work on that. I mean, you filed a supplemental authority, this City of Monroe against Bridgestone case, and I take it you are relying very much on, or you're saying, like Bridgestone, there's a divergence between internal reports and external statements on the same subject. That's some of your...
I think many of the authorities, Your Honor, use common sense and say, if the top people talking about the top products are making statements, either with knowledge or with a failure to execute their duty to investigate before they speak, I think that is a generic proposition that you see throughout the cases. After all, the PSLRA did not repeal the securities laws. Obviously, there's a tension here, just as there's a tension between that pleading requirement and Judge Oberdorfer's recognition, the jury trial right.
Well,
you can't ask, and I don't think the PSLRA asks, that anything be proven or anything be weighed.
No, it doesn't, but it does. I mean, what you see throughout the district court's opinion, though, is a concern that what she at least understood to be the level of detail required had not been furnished. You know, details in reports, details about who made reports, were they in a position to know, details of many kinds like that. And if she's right that kind of detail needs to be there and you essentially can't bring these cases without an inside source, then that's one outcome. If you can actually bring them without an inside source, you can read the 10-Ks and you can read other things, then she set the bar too high. I mean, that's...
I think she set the bar too high. Everyone seems to agree you don't have to plead evidence under the PSLRA. That's never been required. A touch of reality says, hey, you've had no discovery. You've had no discovery. Does this case seem plausible? Is there that strong inference? And... with deference to the district judge, I believe she played the atomizing game. She says this, 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 this. She didn't do what I think it was Judge Posner suggested be done in a different context, get the synergy, the context, the larger picture. Several of the courts of appeals since the PSLRA have made it clear. You can aggregate the facts. You can aggregate the elements of the picture to say, okay, that's the strong inference, even if that fact doesn't do it and that fact doesn't do it. And when I referred earlier to a failure of process, that's part of what I refer to.
I want to go back to, though, this notice, and I know that you're trying to make this recklessness, but I keep thinking that there needs to be something in it for them. And I take it you're not really relying anymore on Mr. Burke's sale of 1% of his holdings. Why was that going to matter?
As I said a minute ago, Your Honor, it's a jigsaw puzzle, and you look at the pieces. And if it's a piece, it is a piece. It's a suspicious moment in time that he is selling because he knows that the roof is going to cave in a bit.
But he's allowing it to cave in on 99% of his holdings.
That is true, but the fact that he was willing to obey the law for 99% of his holdings and violate it for 1% of his holdings is not a an argument against the fact that he did something self-interested. But again, we don't know motive. We're looking at two people whose lives are so bound up in a company that failure is professional failure, societal failure, industry failure. All I'm saying is that that's part of a picture, but we do not rely on it. We really believe that they knew. And if they didn't know, they sure had a duty to find out before they spoke. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. We'll hear now from Mr. Graham.
May it please the court. Your Honors, Mr. Miller had a lot of rhetorical statements there, but you heard very little about the actual allegations of this complaint that were analyzed in detail by Judge St. Eve. And there's a reason that you heard very little tied to the actual allegations. It's because the actual allegations don't come close in this instance, under the standards set by any circuit in the United States, to meeting the requirements of the PSLRA.
But you know, Mr. Graham, that might be an overstatement. I really do think this case is about finding where on the spectrum one needs to go, because taking it one extreme, you know, the forms that follow the federal rules of civil procedure, this complaint, you know, is a great big fat thing, you know, the second amended complaint with all sorts of details in it. It doesn't have names, ranks, serial numbers, dates, you know, whether you walked in the room at 3 o'clock in the afternoon or four, kinds of details in it. But I think it really does raise a very interesting question about how much detail is contemplated by Congress, by the statute, to allow this kind of case to go forward. And just to take one point, some circuits seem to think that motive and opportunity really always needs to be part of these cases. Other circuits think not, and they'll say, well, that's one way you can go about proving this, but not the only way. I tend to think, frankly, it would not be a very useful way to go about it in this case, unless somebody can tell me how Mr. Notebart and Mr. Burke's behavior personally benefited either them or, for that matter, the company. But suppose we resolve that and say it's really just one way of going about it and there are other ways. Then suddenly you are looking at something where it looks like the inside information was that these products, particularly the 5500, was in trouble.
With respect, Your Honor, let me just go back for a second to the pleading standard. What we told the district court below and what she adopted was exactly what Your Honor just suggested, and that is, our view, although it doesn't decide the case, our view is that motive and opportunity is simply one factor to consider.
Right, and she said that too.
And she said that too.
There's some divergence in the circuits on that point.
There is. And we think the better rule, even though a motive and opportunity test we think would favor us in some ways, we think the better rule is you look on it all together in terms of the totality of it. But I want to address your point there about there being information in terms of the 5500. Because, Your Honor, this is not a new point for this circuit. You go back pre-PSLRA to the Arazi versus Mullane case that this circuit decided in 1993. That was a securities law case. Same kinds of allegations that there was internal information. And this court found that superficially, on the face of it, on a motion to dismiss, the kind of broad allegations there were absolutely insufficient. This is a pre-PSLRA. Now, the reason that's important...
But I haven't gone back to look at the complaint in that case. I mean, the fact is the complaint in this case does give information about that background study. I keep forgetting their name, that outside firm did.
Your Honor, I want to focus on that. Let me come right to that, because I think that that is their best shot at doing something. What they say was there was a probe report that was prepared in or about early 2001 that they said showed there was going to be a decline for T1 circuits and that that in turn would affect the sales of the 5500. Now, the timing is critical. And here's why the timing is critical. Because, in fact, the company itself announced in the first half of 2001 declines. And the probe report, where no timing was given, let me just take one specific. On April 18th, 2001, the company stood up. Mr. Notabart stood up. And this is supposedly part of the fraud in this case, Your Honor. He stood up and said, the revenues for this year, the projection is being taken down from $4.4 billion to $3.6 billion. That's an $800 million decline in the revenue projection. Now, the probe report they talk about was a $400 million impact that they said. So even assuming, and the complaint doesn't plead that the probe report was available at that time period, and there's a reason it doesn't, it wasn't. But put that to one side. The complaint doesn't even say it's available then. Even if you assume it was available then, what the company did was announce an $800 million decline in revenue projections. How does that suggest fraud? Now, I heard references to let's take a look at the synergy here. That's just a fancy way of saying let's ignore the facts that are actually pleaded.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, you know, there are... Look, I mean, we all know in retrospect, and of course we're trying to look ex ante here, but the period of time from late 2000 to into early 2001 was a period of great activity, let's say, some of it negative, in this industry, because Y2K had come, and people were doing all kinds of orders and things like that were happening. So when you're out there trying to tell consumers, investors, you're trying to tell investors, this is a great stock, buy this stock, nothing's wrong, we're going to keep selling at our same pace, and the evidence suggests you're not, your confidential informants, which I know that you've said they're too vague, and they've come back and said, well, actually, they're much more specific than the ones in Chubb, et cetera, we'll just have to take a look at that. But it looks a lot like the Firestone situation. The internal reports are saying one thing, and they're out there saying something else.
With respect, to Your Honor, that is, this is not Firestone or anything close to it, and it's important to pay attention to the particulars here. There are three allegations regarding internal documents that are allegedly and somehow gave rise to contrary information. First, there was an allegation from an unnamed source that somehow the third and fourth quarter data showed a decline in demand. Nothing more specific about what it showed, who received it. By the way, no allegation that Mr. Notabart ever received it than Mr. Burke, but nothing more specific. Now, the reason that that's so important is because the financial data that was reported for the third and fourth quarter showed that, in fact, Telabs had absolutely record sales in the third and fourth quarter. The fourth quarter was their first billion-dollar quarter. There was an increase of 49% in sales.
Right, that's part of the plaintiff's case, though, that all these sales were pushed into the fourth quarter.
That what it does is it falls back down onto the allegations that there was financial fraud. But in terms of the sales figures are way, way up there. And all they have on the third and fourth quarter is a completely unspecific allegation that there are reports showing declining demand without saying how much it's declining, whether those are final reports, who they went to, what it's being measured against. Is it being measured intra-quarter, inter-quarter, year-to-year?
And how are they going to get all that data without discovery? Really, without hiring an industrial spy or something, you know, what are they supposed to do?
Well, actually, there is a practical answer to that question. There are two answers. One is that, obviously, Congress made a policy judgment, and that is that Congress made a policy judgment that rather than going off on the fishing expeditions, it was more important that there be specificity at the front end, because they made the determination that wasteful lawsuits have an impact both on the stock market and on reputations that don't merit this. So to the extent there's a problem there, that was a congressional judgment. But the practical answer to Your Honor is, in fact, there are methods to get information. For example,
Delaware corporations, which Telabs is, and most corporations are, as Your Honor is well aware, has a procedure for inspection of books and records, which the Delaware courts have repeatedly said is a methodology for shareholders who want to determine if there may have been some wrongdoing to utilize before bringing a lawsuit. That wasn't done here. It hasn't been done in other cases. There are mechanisms to do it, but to the extent that there's a problem, Your Honor, that's the result of a congressional judgment. And the question here is not starting from scratch. What is the policy that we believe should be adopted? It's whether there's been compliance with the policy that Congress did adopt,
which
was the requirement of a strong inference.
Yeah.
Now, what I was saying is there are only three sets of internal document allegations that are in this complaint. One is the generalized allegation that there was something about the third and fourth quarter that showed declining demand, which, of course, is contrary to the facts.
Well, but the district court finds that the channel stuffing allegation, for example, is a sound, it meets the standards. It's scienter that she finds the case founders on.
She does not credit the allegation about there being declining demand in the third and fourth quarter. Your Honor is absolutely correct that she found that there were sufficient allegations to find that somewhere in the organization somebody may have been over inventory. Now, we've taken issue with that on this appeal.
We think that
was incorrect.
But let's grant it
for the second. The question is, what's the linkage between that and Mr. Notabart? And what Mr. Notabart was accused of was one sentence, and that is that it said that he worked directly with Telab sales personnel to channel stuff SBC. Now, it wasn't just once that we raised this point. We raised it after their First Amendment complaint as well, which was that channel stuffing, when you just...
Excuse me, Mr. Graham. If you would stand in front of the podium, we'd be able to pick your voice up on the microphone,
Your Honor.
And the tape, and that's very important when we go back and study the case.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Thank you. Channel stuffing can be used as a conclusory characterization. It's a question of what's underneath it, and it can be defined differently. For example, in the First Circuit, the Cabletron case defines channel stuffing in that instance as being instances where there was a right of return that was agreed beforehand. In this case, channel stuffing was much broader.
Well, it may have been, except I read that part of the district court's opinion as something saying, in the, shall we say, pejorative sense, I think that the plaintiffs have alleged enough about channel stuffing to get over that part of the hurdle they face. And what she then, of course, goes on to is scienter.
But, Your Honor, not with regard to Mr. Notabart. In other words, if I can summarize what I believe the district court said.
May we, though, consider that channel stuffing in light of everything else that was going on.
You have to consider it. We agree that you consider the totality of the complaint here. But the allegation of channel stuffing is that some lower-level employees over-inventoried in some way. And it really comes down to this telco buy. With Mr. Notabart, who only arrived at the company, by the way, in September of 2000, from having come from Ameritech, with Mr. Notabart, the only claim is that he worked with Telabs personnel to channel stuff SBC. But since they've defined channel stuffing as including discounts and incentives, the district court quite properly said, this doesn't tell me what he did, what Mr. Notabart did. It doesn't tell me what he knew. You may have had enough to say that somebody out there at the lower levels of the organization was over-inventorying, but you haven't made a link that any of the executive officers are involved in this, much less Mr. Notabart.
But the allegation—I mean, I realize you have a lot to do in your 20 minutes—but the allegation is, you know, this is a case against Mr. Notabart, this is a case against Mr. Burke, and of course, it's a case against the company as
That's
a whole.
Correct.
And somehow, you have to get all of that covered. With respect to the two individuals, it is that this was, in fact, a corporate policy. It was a policy to try to make the company look better and stronger over this period of time. And I've already said, you know, in court that I'm, you know, not at rest at exactly why that really helps the company, since eventually, of course, the truth comes out. And this is a very short-term strategy. But nonetheless, that's, as I understand it, that's the allegation that we're working with.
Your Honor, with respect once again, I don't believe that there is an allegation in this complaint that says this was corporate policy, much less says that any of the people named as individual defendants made it corporate policy, were aware of such a policy, or gave any such orders. There is no such allegation in this complaint, much less anything that would have any kind of factual particularity to back it up.
But you agreed, I thought, in your brief that you do take the specificity that the PSLRA requires, but at the end of the day, it's still a 12B6 assessment, and so inferences are drawn in favor of the party opposing dismissal.
No, Your Honor. Yes, or I should say yes and no. The answer is that inferences are drawn only to the extent that you have an adequately pleaded factual basis.
Well, that's right. You get the factual foundation, but then at that point, you draw the inferences in favor of the party opposing the motion.
If you have the factual foundation. But the requisite factual foundation is the issue here to allow you to draw the inference. And when I made reference before to the synergy here, I was actually going to echo a point that Your Honor has already pointed out, which is actually quite important here, notwithstanding the fact that motive and opportunity are not part of it. Despite what Mr. Miller says, it's not as if the court blinds its eyes to the realities here. It's not as if you say to yourself in looking at inferences and in determining whether there is a quote-unquote strong inference is required, what are the competing inferences? What else is going on there? Of course, if there are strong inferences both for and against, yes, you can choose the strong inference for. I agree with that. But in evaluating whether an inference is strong, you do have to look at the other information. And part of that is motive here, because what kind of an irrational scheme is it that produces no short-term benefit or long-term benefit either to the company or the individuals involved? And this is, again, echoing what this circuit itself has previously recognized.
But that has to assume that there's absolutely no benefit to the company itself. Forget about Note Barton Burke for the moment. There's no benefit to the company itself from the fact that in the middle of February 2001, its stock is valued at a rather high, or at least historically high, level. And that seems a little odd. I mean, companies like it when the market evaluates their stock.
But they don't like it when they give projections and then have their stock come crashing down and do it in a matter of months, Your Honor. And there's no benefit to that. And with respect, there's no attempt to benefit, to plead the benefit. So what we have here is we have a situation where you have irrationality. And in the DeLeo case, Judge Easterbrook correctly pointed out, if you're going to deal with a situation where people are accused of taking irrational actions, your threshold for what's going to be an adequate factual basis to create an inference that they did that had better be very high. And it isn't here. That's equivalent to the strong inference, and it isn't here. Now, I've spoken a lot about Mr. Notabard in terms of the financials. Let me just the channel stuffing I've addressed. I think I've addressed the question about the one other statement that of his on the March 8th, where he says that it's strong acceptance, still strong growth, basically, for the 5,500. And again, let me just point out, there's no dispute here that during the first quarter that there was 21% revenue growth. And that there's no claim that the statement that the company made that the growth only tailed off in the last few weeks because customers pushed out orders. There's no claim that that statement was false. And, Your Honors, once again, the company revised its own projections downwards on April 7th and again on April 18th, $800 million. What kind of a fraud is it where you revise it downwards and then you have another revision downwards 2 months later in June and they say, well, now that's the real truth. That shows that there's fraud here. One last point. On the 6,500, only allegation linking Mr. Notabart to any of this was an allegation from a source who was not even with the company during the period in question, had left the company before the class period, and yet he's the one that supposedly provides information about what Mr. Notabart knew in March and April of 2001, even though the employee had left in 2000. It's CS3. And in that regard, all he says is that Mr. Notabart had notice of problems regarding the 6,500, which isn't contrary to any of the statements made, since there were simply customer evaluations that were going on, and all that Notabart said is there's big demand for this project. I want to make one point about the 6,500. The company didn't book any revenues for the 6,500, and it said that in all of its analyst conference calls. It said customers were testing the product, and that there was a demand in the sense that customers wanted it shipped out, that they couldn't book revenues until it was finally installed, that they worked things through. There were no revenues booked during this period. It's a piece of the puzzle that cuts the opposite way.
But it's one thing to say customers are asking for this product to be shipped for testing, but if you had added, and no one likes what they're seeing so far, it certainly would have cast a different light on people's prospects for the company.
If somebody said nobody likes what they're seeing so far, you'd have to have some basis in this complaint for showing that that's what Mr. Notabart was being told about the 6500, and he wasn't. That isn't what the allegations are. All it is CS3. Mr. Burke, the only allegations in this complaint are the 1%. There's nothing linking him to any information, not even a single source other than generalized. He was chairman of the board, an outside director, Your Honors, not even an officer. He was chairman of the board, and therefore he received information from time to time. And that brings us down then to the company itself, Tellabs, and whether or not somehow you can have Scienter independent of any of the individual officers or directors. And Your Honors, on this one, we think that the Fifth Circuit got it absolutely correct, that in a situation where you're dealing with a subjective state of mind, at the end of the day, you have to identify some individual with that subjective state of mind in order to have a scienter claim. And whereas here, the claim is that the individual defendants are the ones that have that scienter, and whereas here, that claim proves not to have a sufficient factual basis, you've got no basis for your claim of scienter against the company. Scienter is not free-floating. It's not absent some individual. It has to inhere in some individual. It's not simply a construct. And that's what the Restatement Second of Agency, Section 275, points out.
So you think we should disapprove the Sixth Circuit's treatment of this in Firestone, Bridgestone?
I do, Your Honor, but I have to say that even under the Sixth Circuit's position in Monroe, we still come out on the right side in terms of the motion to dismiss, because even in that case, there was an individual who was identified as having scienter. Now, the Fifth Circuit said it has to be the individual making the misstatement that has to have the scienter. The Sixth Circuit, while not directly addressing that question, seems to have said that so long as another executive officer has the scienter, it suffices. Here we have no executive officer with the scienter. They dropped their allegations against the other executive officers, and all we have left is Mr. Notabart, whose claims of scienter are insufficient. I thank you for your time. We respectfully suggest, Your Honors, that this is a case in which the decision of the district court should be affirmed in all respects.
Thank you, Mr. Graham. Mr. Miller, you have 5 minutes.
Let me quickly deal with 2 points raised at the end of my learned colleague's argument. Your Honor, you were quite right in pointing to City of Monroe. I think City of Monroe is a case in which there is no individual being charged with a securities violation. One was dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. The other didn't make the grade. That's an important point. A corporation acts through its officers, directors, agents, employees. This circuit said so in the Highway 45 case. There are many, many instances in which there is scienter in terms of the overt conduct of the corporation, but there isn't an individual who is prosecuted under the securities law, either because that individual is dead, just to take a dramatic case, or there is no jurisdiction over that individual, or under the central bank case, that is not an individual who ever spoke publicly and therefore is not subject to 10b-5 type. In this case, Notabart and Burke, whatever their motivation, hoping for that glorious turnaround in the second or third quarter of 01, hoping you could string it out long enough so that the orders and revenues at the back end would catch up and prove you right so that it would never emerge, and then in the end of the second quarter of 01, realizing that's not going to happen, so you have to fess up. The corporation, through its company documents, like the 10K, like letters to shareholders, like the annual reports, was making statements to the public, to the investing public, picked up by the analysts, projected by the analysts, which were completely discordant with reality. And we submit that under City of Monroe, creates liability under the securities law, whether Notabart or Burke were involved. As to Burke, It's important to remember that Burke signed the 10-K. Burke signed the annual report. Burke signed a letter to shareholders in which some of these statements were being made. So Burke is not on vacation walking the Great Wall of China throughout this period. He is involved. And if I had founded a corporation by the name of Tell Labs in 1970, I surely would remain involved, particularly as chairman of the board in 2001. A line was penned by this circuit. I believe Judge Easterbrook penned it. I believe you were on the panel in the Jakubowski case about 6 years ago. Deliberate ignorance is a form of knowledge. And it's a wonderful line because, in a curious way, I think that the defendants are between a rock and a hard place. They can't say they knew because that clearly would be reckless and violative under any standard. They can't say they were ignorant because that, too, is the equivalent of knowledge, particularly given the duty they had to inform themselves before they spoke. So they try to elide all of those questions of what is it that these people knew by picking away at one confidential source or another confidential source when there were 27 confidential sources, all speaking corroboratively with a single picture of a company in deep trouble and trying to mask that deep trouble with these statements to the public. Remember the district court findings. The district court found that there was a misstatement as to the 5,500 with regard to not seeing any dimming out, you know, we're maintaining its growth. That's made on March 8th when they know. They know it's not maintaining its growth. The court found actionable the statement that the 6,500 is available in December of 2000 when the confidential sources say it didn't even show up until the first quarter of 2002. She found actionable the notion of strong acceptance, new products is strong, tied to the 30% projection. This is a statement made on March 7. Given the strong acceptance of the 6,500, there was none, we project 30%. She found that actionable, and she found actionable this business about manufacturing and we're building and shipping. Nothing was being shipped. She found all of that actionable. She also found actionable channel stuffing, over-inventorying, and backdating. As Judge Ripple points out, maybe that's not enough in and of itself. Also, some courts would say that's enough, but in conjunction with the other three statements, the district court found actionable. How can you come to the conclusion there isn't a strong inference of scienter? And we believe there's much more that she made mistakes on. Thank you, Your Honor.
Our thanks to both counsel for very fine oral arguments today. And the case will be taken under advisement.